Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Got to talk about the U.S. vote on TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok facing its most serious challenge yet. This after the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill to ban the app. That is, unless its Chinese owner sells the video sharing app. Representative Buddy Carter is a Republican from the state of Georgia who co-sponsored the bill to ban TikTok on Bloomberg Tech earlier today. Right after the vote, he said the law is an important national security measure and not a ban. Check out what he had to say.
Two questions here. First of all, this is a question about, is it going to be banned? No, they have to divest themselves. That's a question that only they can answer. The second question is us in Congress, us in the House and in the Senate. And that is, this is about national security. Now, are we going to take national security seriously?
That's Representative Buddy Carter, Republican from the state of Georgia, who co-sponsored the ban. The bill, to ban TikTok earlier today.
All right. So, Tim, let's get more on this. Let's turn to Bloomberg News national security reporter Dan Flatley. He's with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Dan, first up, the vote in the House, 352 to 65. Before we move on to the Senate vote, which is a whole other story, what do we need to know about the lead up to today's vote and today's overwhelming vote in favor of banning TikTok, or at least telling them they've got to do something?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you had told people a week or so ago that there was going to be a bipartisan vote in the House of Representatives that was going to get 352 votes in favor of something, they probably would have laughed you out of the room. I mean, this is a Congress, especially in the House, that has been sort of mired in a lot of dysfunction. There's been fights over who's going to be Speaker, all of this stuff. But, you know, TikTok has been one of those things. Every once in a while, the stars sort of align in Washington. And this is a case where, you know, this sort of happened. TikTok has been a long-standing national security concern for a lot of folks on the Hill. And two individuals in particular, Chairman Mike Gallagher, who's the chairman of this committee that's focused on competition with China, and his Democratic counterpart, Raja Krishnamoorthy, sort of worked behind the scenes very quietly over the last several months, building consensus, building support for this carefully crafted, as they say, bill, and working with the administration to kind of line everything up. And, you know, it's an election year. There's a lot of different things, a lot of different strains to follow. And they got it done, and they got it done without anybody really finding out about it, including TikTok's lobbyists, apparently. So, you know, that's a pretty impressive feat in Washington these days. Yeah, so.
Danny, I just want to know about the security concern here, because this is an app that, as you write in the piece, 170 million Americans use. Critics do call it a national security threat. What can you tell us about whether or not it is a national security threat? What do critics say?
Right. So, you know, there's a couple of things that critics of TikTok sort of focus on. Obviously, there's the data issue, which is probably where a lot of experts sort of say they're on their firmest ground. If you recall, several years ago now, the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government passed a law that any tech company or any company really could be required to turn over data to the government if asked for it. And so, you know, the TikTok folks have said and been clear about, you know, the fact that they are not sharing data with the Chinese government, but they can't give lawmakers on Capitol Hill or folks here in the Biden administration enough comfort with that sort of guarantee to basically counteract what people are seeing Chinese government do. So that's kind of part one. Part two is this question of propaganda influence. You know, there's a big thing, I'm sure you both will remember all the Russia disinformation mm-hmm. around the 2016 election that happened to, you know, there was iterations of that in 2020. This is a very sensitive area for a lot of different reasons. And in a way, what happened last week where you had a lot of folks from TikTok sort of prompted by the app to call their representatives is on the one hand, sort of American democracy in action, right? And that's what TikTok's proponents say it is. On the other hand, it's sort of like, oh, is this an influence campaign? Is this something that could mobilize a lot of people to do something that they might otherwise not do? And I think that's how the lawmakers on Capitol Hill chose to interpret that particular event.
Right.
So there's data, propaganda, influence, all that sort of stuff.
Hey, just got about a minute left here. Dan, I do wonder, it now moves to the Senate. Our Josh Green out in the BW newsletter writing that the biggest obstacle to a ban on TikTok is that there are so many politicians with competing plans and big egos eager to impose one. And we're talking about senators already picking nits with the House plan. What's the outlook of this getting through the Senate anytime soon? And got about 35 seconds.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, big egos are not in short supply in the United States Senate. That's for sure. Everybody has kind of their idea of how they want to do this. It all comes down to the chairs, the committee chairmen and chairwomen, and what Schumer and McConnell want to do. And, you know, they may arrive at a solution that moves quickly or they may not. Experience would tend to say they will not arrive at something very quickly, but you never know. Sometimes when something is moving, it's moving and you can't stop it. So we'll just have to see. We'll know right. a little bit more in the coming days.
Or somebody tweets and then the whole conversation changes.
Carol, all I'm going to say is get your TikToks in now, okay?
I'm not a TikToker, folks. I'm not even on Facebook. Okay? I'm not on any of that stuff.
Get them in while you can.
Just going to say, Dan, appreciate it. We know it's a busy day for you. Bloomberg News, National Security reporter Dan Flatley.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, I got to say, it's a story that we knew we so wanted to do as soon as it crossed the Bloomberg late yesterday. First of all, it's because it's from Ashley Vance. And secondly, because it does have a big time element when it comes to the AI craze, Tim, but with a little bit of a twist.
Yeah, it turns out making robots smart, not so easy. Enter Physical Intelligence. It's a new company. It's giving its first public interview since founding the company. That interview, of course, to Ashley Vance, Bloomberg Businessweek features writer. Ashley, also the author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for a fantastic future. And when the heavens went on sale, the misfits and geniuses racing to put space within reach.
Listen, we're just going to say it. He's our go-to for a peek into the world's future. Ashley Vance, of course, joining us from California, Palo Alto. Ashley, really good to have you here with us. I love how the story starts. We both do. In that when you think about like the big screen or movies or science fiction, when we think about robots, they're very human-like and they can kind of do anything. Turns out in real life, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. You know, the every science fiction world I think we've ever encountered usually has very smart computers and very smart androids and other robots walking around. But our world has been different. These large language models that have become so famous from OpenAI and Google and others, you know, they're stuck on our computers and our robots in factories and even in the home have lagged behind this new, more general purpose form of intelligence.
All right. So then take us to Physical Intelligence, the company that you write about and the CEO that you got to talk to, the first interview since these guys were founded. Tell us who they are and what they're up to, because they're trying to change this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a collection of robotics and AI experts. A bunch of them come from Google. Google's had this robotics team for a long time, and then there's some professors and some entrepreneurs in this group. And yeah, the big problem here is that the AI that we're used to, these chatbots, they get fed with all of the billions and trillions of words on the internet and books we've written. And so the quest is, how do you feed robots enough data to train them on these AI models? And this group of researchers, they just think this time has come where we can gather enough data in the right way to make a general purpose robotics brain. So not not software for one robot, but a type of operating system that you could apply to any machine, and it would have this base level of intelligence to perform tasks.
How do you teach, Ashley, a robot to tie a shoe, for example, to do a basic task?
Yeah, this part's cool. So, you know, the way this has been done for the last like 5 or 10 years is you buy a bunch of robotic arms, or you build them, and you have them tie a shoe about 1 million or 10 million times until that, and you tell it what it's doing a bad job and what it's doing a good job, and eventually this little robot hand can tie a shoe. What these guys are talking about is this new era where you do actually take the language AI models and infuse it into these physical models. And so now, already today, this is happening where you can tell one of these robots tie a shoe, and because of these language models, it probably, and you know, all of our image and video models, it has a pretty good idea of what the concept of a shoe is, what the shoelaces are. There's probably a lot of videos on the internet of people teaching kids to tie shoes, and so it sort of comes in with this knowledge. Same sort of thing. If you said, you know, pick the Coke can off the table, it will know what a Coke can is and be able to separate that object from other objects. So they're trying to piggyback on this base level of general intelligence and then build the mechanical parts into it.
Ashley, when this processing is happening in real time, is it happening separate from the cloud? That is the actual brain of something with physical intelligence? Like, is the vision for that actual brain to be physically inside the robot versus that processing happening offsite in the cloud, independent from, you know, the physical thing?
Yeah, like to a degree, all these models have to get trained in the cloud because they require tens of thousands of these graphics chips to do the training. But we're seeing more and more, even with like a language model, you know, you can ask ChatGPT questions on your cell phone and have them answered. So the part where you've trained the model happens off in the cloud in these huge data centers, but the robots will have this kind of local intelligence, just like we do on our devices. And that stuff, I have another story coming soon on how all this processing on the devices themselves is going to get faster as well.
Love this. Having said that, you know, talking to ChatGPT to create a poem or something, is that easier than actually, you know, getting the next generation AI to teach someone to physically do something? And I guess, what's the data sets on that? Are there less data sets on that to actually teach these physical capabilities?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like this is a done deal. It's sort of.
I just want someone at home to do my laundry other than me. That's what I'm talking about, Ashley.
We're getting close. I mean, it's funny because robotics, I think we've had these sort of like false hopes so many times where it seems like they're about to do all these incredible things, and they never seem to do it. And the challenges here are real. I mean, this gathering of the data is still a problem. Physical Intelligence's plan is to, most of the companies so far, they've built their own robot and it's a single thing and they train that single thing really well. Physical Intelligence wants to buy robots from everybody, smart machines from everybody, train this general purpose data set. So they're just going to buy them, run their AI software through it and gather this data. But then they also think we are, because of the advances that have happened in AI the last 4 years, that we're at a new spot where a new era of robotics is possible. But, you know, all of this is theoretical. They're not the only company trying to do this. It's a bit of a race now that has just begun this year. And you know, we'll see if somebody can actually solve this problem.
Well, Ashley, what does the end of that race look like? And you know, you've spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley. You've spent the past couple of years immersed in this type of technology. How close are we to that finish line?
It's interesting that, you know, there's companies, a prominent company called Figure AI. It's just raised more than $600 million to build an Android. Tesla as this Optimus Android. There's other companies doing that. So, you know, in terms of the actual like machines over the past 18 months, I've seen this huge leap forward. I've been to Figure's factory. I mean, the Androids are cool, you know, and they can move and all over the place. They've got these cameras. They can see forward, backward, all around. And I've seen them carrying boxes in like a makeshift warehouse. So that part is okay. It's still this software layer. I mean, you can teach a robot to do a repetitive task today. You just cannot send it out into the world, almost like a self-driving car where it has to deal with these variables right. of the world. We're just not to that point yet.
That's exactly what I thought about when I read your story. Is it akin to Tesla and the other companies that are creating the autonomous vehicle technology, right? So that they can put it, I mean, they could essentially then sell it to whatever car or whatever vehicle, but fine tuning it so it really gets it right every time. That's kind of what this is about, right?
It is. And, you know, like with those cars, I mean, we forget this is like a decade long effort. Mm-hmm. So they've been gathering data for this decade of all the streets and roads and signs and what people and bikes look like. In this case, same thing. I mean, maybe you have enough money to build 20 prototype robots. Is that enough to gather the amount of data that we're talking about here? I think the stakes are very high out on a road with a car. Maybe, you know, if we're just talking about sort of like a factory robot doing a bunch of different jobs, that's probably a less dangerous and sort of easier thing to get to. If you start putting it in the home, you know, obviously you want that to be safe. So there's this, but this is the question. It's this race. These people think they have figured out a new way to gather this data, but we're still just not totally sure.
Like C-3PO and R2-D2. Sorry, it's been a while since I watched it. But, you know, that's what we think about. Like, these guys could do a lot of stuff.
They can. Okay, so Ashley, you've spent time at Figure AI. As I said, you've been doing this for years. What scares you about this tech, if anything?
Well, you know, I think we're like a long way off from this, getting to some robot that's barging around your house, taking it over. I think, you know, I mean, it's similar to so many of these questions. Already, Figure doesn't like to talk about this. They talk about the robots being complements, but clearly they're trying to you know, do jobs that humans do today in warehouses. They're probably not the most pleasant jobs, but they are. There's a lot of jobs and they pay. And so, you know, there's a challenge coming with that. I think in general, well, and then also you're talking about all these huge fears we have about AI. I mean, you're giving it a body and it seems a little less scary sometimes when it's stuck on a computer instead of acting out in the world. And so this would be a new era in our AI conundrum.
Yeah. Just another one. really great stuff. Really great stuff. And so much stuff and some history in terms of other companies that have tried to do it before and all of those that are out there also pursuing something similar to this company. Ashley, thank you so much. Like we said, we saw this company last night when it crossed the Bloomberg and knew we wanted to chat with you about it. So thank you. Really appreciate it. That is, of course, Bloomberg Business Week feature writer Ashley Vance.
The real Ashley Vance, not an AI version of Ashley Vance.
No AI there.
No,
it's
the
just,
real.
It's just intelligence.
The real human Ashley Vance.
We think. Do we know?
That would be a feature.
Speaking of features, his story is featured in the forthcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week. You can read it now, though, on the Bloomberg Terminal, of course, at Bloomberg.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Need a loan for a new factory or a buyout deal but don't have the terms or like the terms that your bank is offering? Well, there's a $1.7 trillion industry that's ready to help. We're talking, of course, about private debt, part of private credit.
All right, big picture, everybody. We've got a chart we want to pull up for everybody. It shows the growth since 2018, specifically the value of current portfolios when it comes to private credit. What it doesn't show, though, is that there's also a lot of unused capital just waiting to be put to work. In 2023, that meant another $500 million or half a billion dollars just waiting for a deal. So that means over $1 trillion, like we said, easily in 2023. But generally, for those on radio who are listening as well, you can just see that in the last 5-6 years, just we continue to incrementally see the growth when it comes to private credit.
Okay, so a little bit of a history lesson here. Private credit came of age after the 2008 financial crisis, and today it's become a serious rival to mainstream lending for all kinds of businesses. Some have argued that private credit should become a permanent fixture in capital markets and investment portfolios, yet it's not quite clear how what some people consider an opaque corner of finance will cope when the next big recession hits.
Two sides to every coin. All right, that brings us to our guest, Kyle Brown. He's president, CEO, and chairman of the publicly held Trinity Capital. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Trinity Capital, by the way, a business development company making both debt and equity plays. Kyle, great to have you here with us.
Thanks
How are you?
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, great to have you here. Private credit, we talk about it so much. It feels like every investment advisor has some thoughts or wanting to be involved in the private credit space. Tell us about the trends that we are seeing and how it compares to the last 6 months to the last 12 months.
Sure. And maybe just a little background. So we've been doing this since 2008, focused on growth stage companies, mostly private companies. Providing senior secured financing in the form of term debt and equipment financing. So anywhere from kind of growth stage heading towards an IPO or liquidity event to M&A PE-backed company after the fact. So private credits continue to grow. It's continued to be, I'd say, maybe even more prevalent over the last 12 months since some of the banking volatility took place. I think what we're seeing is banks lending less and companies looking for alternative sources of capital. And so pipeline-wise, it's been significant growth over the last 12 months specifically, although it's been steadily growing, you know, over the last 5 years.
What can you tell us about, I mean, speaking generally here, because every deal is different, but what are typical terms on a deal and how might they be different from the type of deal that someone were able to get from financing from a quote-unquote traditional means?
Sure. So, you know, in most cases, you're going to see a little bit less leverage, particularly with kind of this growth stage sector. We average anywhere from 20 to 30% loan to value, meaning the last priced round or last 409 valuation, lower of the two. So they're lightly leveraged companies, right? They are, you know, they're growing.
Is that something you guys specifically, you want light leverage?
Lighter leverage, right? Yeah. I think what you see there is less impact from rate increases as a result of that. You know, companies, a 300 to 500 basis point increase is not significantly impacting their bottom line. It's challenging it, but it's not significantly impacting them.
If I can build on what Tim just asked you, in terms of terms, though, specifically for the deals you are doing, whether it's over the past 6 months or so or last 12 months, have you been asking for companies to pay more to get a deal done because you're concerned about their exposure to whatever, or you're worried about the business environment or whatever?
I think our gross yields have been rising. I mean, they have been. You can see it on our investor presentation online. But the gross yields have been rising. Warrants and some extra equity kickers have been rising as well. And that's really more of a product of just supply and demand. There's less capital available. They're getting less capital from banks. And
so you can do it, in other words.
So we can do it, right. And there's an exchange there. So we have finite amount of capital as well, right, alternative lenders. And so we're getting a little bit better pricing over the last 12 to 24 months.
Because you can.
Because we can.
What would you say to critics who say that this is indeed an opaque corner of finance?
I think it's been around for a long time. Right.
Has it been tested, though? You came in 2008, yeah. Or your firm has. Mm-hmm. Do you really feel like it's been tested?
So I think that venture capital has steadily been building equity investments as well as private equity investments. And so that market hasn't changed. Even after 2000, you saw a pretty big rebound in the amount of capital that's deployed in 2021. So I think investments, particularly in technology where we focus, it's a good play. And it's been tested multiple times, especially over the last 4 to 5 years, right? With COVID, with inflation increasing, equity investors continue to support companies. The biggest challenge I think you're seeing out there, it's not are these companies going to survive or can they make it? It's at what valuation will they continue to raise capital? And you're seeing pretty significant valuation fluctuations right now.
I am also curious about the exit strategy. How quickly do you guys normally exit an investment?
So a third of our deals are we repaid through an IPO or M&A. A third is through just regular payoffs. So our deals end up amortizing. You talk about terms. They're interest only for 12 to 36 months payments, and then they're fully amortizing over 24 to 36 months. And so,
3 years and you're out?
We're typically out in less than 3 years.
And that's been consistent even over, let's coming off the pandemic, has that stayed consistent?
It's been very, very consistent. The other corner is just refinances. We'll get refinanced out if it's a strong company that continues to grow.
What do approvals denials look like in terms of companies coming to you? Like, what is the success rate for incoming versus, you know, you guys saying, okay, hey, this is not quite a fit for us providing financing?
Yeah, I think historically we've averaged maybe 3% of the deals we look at, right? That's companies where we've seen multiple years of financial statements, pitch deck, cap table. So we're getting a good look, and we're only funding about 3% of those. Wow. That has actually narrowed over the last 12 to 18 months. Top of funnel's increased because deal flow's increased since the banking volatility. And then we're just getting a little bit pickier on what makes it to the bottom.
Why are you getting pickier?
We want to make sure that companies have the adequate runway to get through the next couple of years of volatility.
Well, you talked about refinancing or refinances in terms of some of your firms. How much do you typically do that for a company that's been in your portfolio? How much more have you done it coming off of maybe the last couple of years when there's been some concerns about some strain and stresses, especially as the environment has gotten a little bit questionable?
So I think we're probably a little bit unique. Our internally managed BDC, and there's only a couple internally managed BDCs, our company in Trinity is not just a pool of assets. It's actually owns the management company. So when you buy the stock, you get the management company. We also have third-party valuations on all of our assets, and there's transparency there for investors, so they can see from us and a third party where these assets are valued at. So there's really no hiding the eight ball from evaluations or from the portfolio standpoint.
So you're not having to do some kind of an increasing number of refinancing, maybe with tougher terms for the borrower in the last 6 to 12 months?
The majority of our investments right now are new investments.
Okay.
80%+ of our capital is being deployed into new opportunities.
You mentioned IPO market, though. Is some of that more difficult in the last 12 months? It's been not
absolutely
a great IPO market.
Yeah.
No, so do you have to shift gears? And rather, you said about a third are IPOs or M&A. Are you doing more M&A and less IPO because that's the market?
There's been more M&A. And honestly, there's going to be a lot more M&A coming up, I think. There's this fine dance happening right now between companies who need capital and private equity. You mentioned at the beginning of the segment, ton of dry powder right now. And there's a dance because this equity is going to be really judged on the investments they make in this time period right now. And then you have companies that were raising at a significant increase in valuation over 2020 to 2022, and they're dancing. They're trying to figure out where to land. And you're seeing significant down rounds, whether it's priced or hidden in the form of a convertible note with preference, et cetera. But it's happening right now, and it'll play out over this year.
We talk about that a lot for those who've got dry powder, and depending on how their exits have been, whether or not it's going to go well in the future. Great stopping by next time you're in town. Come by.
Thank you very
much. Kyle Brown, Chief Executive Officer at Trinity Capital, joining us here in studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Tim, we know investors watching a lot of different things right now.
Yeah, they're keeping their eyes on a lot this year, including the upcoming presidential elections, where U.S. immigration is certainly top of mind. On that, for politicians in Washington and New York City, an unprecedented stream of asylum seekers presents an intractable problem with no easy answers. For companies such as Tyson Foods that are struggling to fill unpleasant jobs with a U.S. unemployment rate of 3.9%, this new population presents an alluring opportunity.
Right. And Tyson joining the nonprofit Tent Partnership for Refugees. It was founded by Chobani yogurt magnate Hamdi Ulukaya. He, with a plan to hire some of the more than 181,000 migrants that have come through New York City's intake system over the past couple of years. As for Tyson, it already employs about 42,000 immigrants among its 120,000 strong U.S. workforce. We've got a great roundtable to get into all of this.
Yeah. Bloomberg News Equality Team reporter Simone Foxman writes about how Tyson and other companies are hiring immigrants. And Garrett Dolan is Senior Manager of Human Resources for Tyson Foods. Simone here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Garrett joining us from Arkansas. We should note Bloomberg LP Carroll, the parent company of Bloomberg Radio, has partnered with Tent to support refugee populations.
All right, so let's get into it. Simone, I want to start with you. First of all, both of you, welcome, welcome. Simone, the migrant crisis, as we know, has been definitely front and center no matter where you live in the U.S. because it's well political and it gets a lot of attention. The nonprofit Tent Partnership for Refugees is trying to help. I've talked to Hamdi about this. What are they doing? Just share with us, remind us what they're up to.
Well, so what we wrote about this week and what what Tyson is involved in is a special, it's an early program to try and get some of these migrants who've come to New York City employed by big companies. There's a broad array of things that Tent does, including mentorship programs, sponsorship programs, et cetera, the things that Bloomberg, for example, are involved in. But this is specific, five different companies, including Tyson, Gate Group. They have been a part of this early program to try and set up employment. Tent has created a database. It allows these employers to look through the database, figure out who they might want to employ, and then ultimately bring those people on to their workforce.
I want to bring in Garrett Dolan, who is Senior Manager of Human Resources for Tyson Foods. Garrett, thanks for joining us on this. A really interesting topic. Carol and I talk about this all the time. It's certainly front and center. And when you know things collide like this with the unemployment rate being so low and it's so hard for companies to get workers, we love talking about this stuff. How hard is it at Tyson to train this population of new workers as they come into the U.S.?
Well, as you probably know, manufacturers across the country are really struggling to fill labor positions, and we are in a very competitive marketplace for labor. There are just more jobs available than people. So we're working really hard to expand the pool of candidates, which include interviewing legally authorized immigrants ready to work. And what makes Tyson so interesting and appealing to these candidates is kind of the wraparound benefits and services that we offer. And let me give you one, for example. Over the last 5 years, Tyson has paid for and helped 5,000 of our team members become citizens. It's because we have a free legal services program. We help them coach with the test, and we help teach them English. That is a benefit that I'm not sure any other company is offering at that scale. And it makes Tyson a unique place because we are tailoring our benefits to meet the needs of the team member wherever they are.
Garrett, how does this influence retention? Are immigrants and refugees, is that population, do you just see a little bit more success at retaining them? I know, you know, there is a big turnover rate in this business, as many as 4 in 10, but does this kind of change the game, hiring immigrants and refugees?
The retention rate for immigrants and refugees is higher than the general labor pool in manufacturing in general and at Tyson. And it is because, I think it's because as they seek stability in their lives and we give them benefits to help wrap around services, to help them connect with the community, to help them learn English, to help them have benefits the very first day, they're very grateful. They develop a sense of loyalty and, you know, as I said before, we're in a very competitive marketplace for labor. So it's a smart business move to tailor your benefits to meet the needs of your employees.
You know, Garrett, we spoke for the story, and one of the big bits of feedback that I got was, well, why doesn't Tyson just simply raise its wages in order to attract more American citizens for these positions? What's your response to that?
It's not just an issue of raising wages. So you can't just raise wages in a business because then you have to raise prices on your products. And so, you know, there's that dynamic that exists all the time. So for our business, we're like we pay the average manufacturing wage of what's paid across America. When you look at labor jobs from the Department of Labor, it's around $37,000 a year. We pay that. But again, what makes us really competitive and really interesting to candidates is the wraparound services, the legal services, the benefits on day one, and so on. And so when people come looking for a job, they're looking for a good wage, but they're also looking for those intangibles that other employers are not offering.
I want to ask you, Garrett, you guys obviously have access to lawmakers. I'm sure there's a dialogue that goes back and forth between Washington and your company and corporate structure. Just the political furor that is around, or fury, I should say, around immigration and immigrants specifically. And I'm thinking about legal immigrants. There are so many that are not able to get to jobs, and the corporate sector is clamoring to have access to them. Why isn't it happening? What is getting in the way? What are you hearing when it seems to be, you know, it's become such a political football, especially ahead of the November election. But what are you hearing? Why aren't more legal immigrants being processed and available to work in the United States?
You know, I'm not really an expert to talk about what's going on at the border. I don't really have much knowledge about border.
But that's
issues.
Not border. That's really what's going on in Washington with lawmakers that represent you. There's obviously conversations that go on.
There are two actions that we would like to see government, nonprofit, and other companies advocate for. And so I can offer you them. We want to increase the pool of candidates that's available for labor. And so what that means is you have to allow people to come into the country and give them a path forward. The second is we want to be able to give a pathway to citizenship, letting people come into the country and keeping it a very temporary window that they can only stay for 18 months. It makes it more difficult to hire those folks when you run a business because you don't want to have to churn those people every 18 months. We would love for there to be a long-term pathway to citizenship, and then we could come in, hire those folks, give them the benefits, and really create that stability that we all want.
I'll add one detail here, which is the immigrants who apply for asylum at the Mexico border, they typically can get work authorization within about 6 months from applying for asylum, you know, paperwork delays, etc. So they are truly legal workers when they are going to places like Tyson. Garrett, I just want to ask you quickly, would you like to see some of the guest worker programs and things beefed up in order to support your hiring needs?
You know, really, I don't have an opinion on that. I don't know much about that program. I'm sorry, but I could try to find someone to help you with that.
Garrett, how about this? I'm just wondering about the workers that you have been able to get through this program. How many more would you like to see? That is, how many more?
Are you willing to hire?
Yeah, right? How many more are you willing to hire at this point?
I would say we want to talk to every possible a qualified candidate. We operate over 100 manufacturing plants over 30 states. We have over 90,000 manufacturing workers, and as you can imagine, keeping them replenished and help finding a stock where we can continue to grow our business, mm-hmm. we need to interview as many as possible.
Yeah, love it. And so glad we could get some time with you. Garrett Dolan, Senior Manager of Human Resources at Tyson Foods, joining us from Arkansas. And of course, our own Simone Foxman, Equality Team Reporter at Bloomberg News. Check her out on the Bloomberg and on Twitter, X at Simone Foxman. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stanovic. And this is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everybody. Just about 18 minutes
more
left.
More about TikTok?
It is largely about TikTok. It's about a lot of things. Okay. It's been an interesting news flow kind of day.
Yeah, it really has.
And I do feel like tech, policy, politics, there's a lot going on.
I mean, everything emanates from Washington. And especially during an election year.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Like everything leads to the November elections.
Well, we heard Bill Maloney say that U.S. steel is falling as a result of President Biden. We're expecting President Biden to soon release a statement of concern about Nippon Steel's proposed purchase.
And who was it that came on our air recently and said, listen, election years are always good because candidates are out there promising everything or talking, you know, because they want to be elected. And that in the bottom line, that ends up being good kind of for the equity trade.
Or you have the Jared Dillians who say the president doesn't matter. It's only the Fed chair.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Many would agree with that one. All right, let's get to it. Let's get to our drive to the close. With us is Kathy Entwistle. She's Managing Director of at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management. Hey, Kathy, nice to have you here. Let's start with the elections. How often are your clients bringing that up here? We've certainly seen a lot of surveys where the elections are top of mind for global investors and global leaders, to be quite honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol, thanks for having me, and also Tim. Basically, our clients definitely have the politics and the election as one of their primary two concerns. I would say inflation is still up there, but the election is also top of mind. And we are getting that question a lot. And even a little bit of the rolling of eyes, like, oh boy, which, you know, what is going to work here? You know, they're just a little frustrated with where we're going with the elections and what kind of promises are being made and maybe not being fulfilled.
Well, how do you set up portfolios for an election where you have an incumbent win or you have a former president whose policies we think we understand because he was president from 2016 to 2020? What happens if he wins? Like, how are you setting up portfolios for that?
That's a great question, Tim. And I would say that when I think about clients and portfolios and election years, I want to be a little bit more conservative this year when I'm thinking about allocations and how to go into this year, as opposed to being a little bit more aggressive and taking a little bit more, you know, steps outside the box or a little bit more risk. So we're going very conservative. We're staying with like value, depending on, you know, who is elected. We also have to think about not just the markets, but some of the other factors such as taxes and how tax strategies or policies may affect a client's portfolio as well. And almost feel like being able to help clients mitigate taxes in their portfolio is going to be really valuable to them.
Interesting that you're saying conservative. That's really fascinating. Is some of it also that, I mean, I'm going to go real simple. You know, the equity universe has had quite a run since October. And remind us, you know, private wealth management means you guys are tapping into a lot of different areas. And whether it's, you know, we had a private credit guest on earlier, whether it's in the private space, give us an idea of kind of some of the investments that you typically are putting your clients into. And I don't know, where do equities fit into that picture?
Sure. So I always start with the big picture, that pie that we all remember, which is the asset allocation pie. And it used to be just, you know, equities and fixed income and a little bit of cash. And in the last like decade or so, alternative investments have become a bigger sleeve in that portfolio if it's something that is appropriate for the client. So what I would say is clients also used to have that typical 60-40 portfolio, right? The 60%
right,
equities,
right,
60% fixed income. And we've been moving away from that, where it might be more like 60 equity, but 20 to 25 fixed income and the balance in alternatives. So we are looking to help bring in, alternatives are considered an asset class that doesn't zig the same way that equities do or fixed income does, that it's non-correlated, so that it's an asset class you can have in your portfolio to kind of dampen volatility.
Is it really non-correlated though, or is it, you know, just mark to market doesn't happen each and every day from 9:30 to 4 p.m.?
Well, if you think about it too, I like to think about like private equity, for example, and I always like talk to clients about the J curve, the letter J. And when you think about the letter J, there's that little tip at the end, right? At the bottom there. And when you're investing in the beginning, there's a lot of things that private equity is investing in, and there's a lot of room to grow. So in the first couple of years, you might not see this big return, but what you'll see at the very end is as the letter J, as the line goes up, that's where the opportunities for growth are. And when you look at that, the hope is that you're looking back at an investment time period that's giving you really nice returns. So I don't think that is anything correlated to the market. We don't normally see that type of strategy or screening when it comes to returns.
What are typically, when you say alternatives is such an umbrella term, it can be like everything from private equity to venture capital.
Right?
It's a huge bucket. When you say alternatives, what are you guys focused on?
I mean, when I look at alternatives, I'm thinking the same about equities. Like when you say stocks, right, or companies that are stocks, you would say, well, we have the large cap and we have the growth and we have the value. And then we have mid-sized companies. And also they have, you know, both the value and the growth tilt. And then you've got international and emerging markets. It's such a plethora of different ways to invest, right? And you can also invest by ETFs or individual stocks, or you can have it managed or go for the index or a mutual funds. You know, there's so many different ways to do that. Well, the alternative investment world has become very busy like that too. There's a lot of different areas of the market that you can address through alternative alternative markets, whether it's on the credit side or the equity side, and whether it's a hedge fund or a private equity fund. There's a lot out there. So it's a matter of really understanding your client. Is it appropriate for them? And where do you find the opportunities to bring that to their portfolio and to their financial, you know, soundness?
Kathy, something I want to ask you, and certainly something we've spent a lot of time talking about over the last couple of years, and that is obviously artificial intelligence, also GLP-1, the new class of weight loss drugs. And I'm curious, among your clients, what are the questions you get the most on? Is it like, tell me about AI, where I can get, you know, where I can make some money? Is it GLP-1 drugs? Is it private credit? Or is it fill in the blank, something else?
It's AI. And it's interesting because a lot of times clients aren't really that aware about alternatives, or they want to get more knowledge about it. So it's not like they're coming to us and saying like, oh, explain, you know, private credit to us. It's more like, what is alternatives and where do we start? What they're coming to, at least to me, for is like, hey, I want to get AI in my portfolio. How do I do that? And it there's many different ways.
Say they do it? We just got about 30, 35 seconds left. How would you say is the best way to get exposure to AI?
I would say through like service companies that are utilizing AI to scale their business, or any kinds of companies that are using it. It doesn't have to be an AI company that's supporting the regular general, you know, run of the road companies with AI. It could be those companies that are generally just your typical companies in, you know, whether it's, you know, financial or energy or, different select industrials.
Right.
Anyone that's using AI, that's the kind of companies that when they're using it in a great way to leverage their business, where they want to go.
Do they usually say, Kathy, but should I be in NVIDIA? Do they also say that real quickly?
I would say headline names are definitely coming up often.
How could it not?
Many days, yeah.
Really appreciate it. Great conversation. Kathy, thanks. Have a great rest of the week. Kathy Entwistle, Managing Director at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.